now moving out to the registers and name servers. And the panel that I'm going to introduce is going to focus our attention on the registers and name server security. And I'd like to introduce Ken Silver, who is going to chair the panel, and he will in turn introduce the panelists. Ken is the moderator. Thank you.
Thank you. With us today, we have representatives from several of the, four TLDs and CERTs. We have Frederico Nieves from .br, Martin Linder from CERT, Gare Rasmussen from .name, and Sabine, okay, great. From .de, which is actually, I think, the third largest TLD. We're all going to give brief presentations, and then shortly after that, we'll have a Q&A session. So I'll go ahead and start off the presentations, and then Sabine will follow, and then Frederico, Jan here, and then Martin. Thank you. Okay. Most of the morning, I think we heard a lot about targeted denial of service attacks. We heard a lot about a lot of malicious behavior for targeted at DNS and the potential vulnerabilities there. Today, I'm going to talk a little bit, very briefly, about both the provisioning side security and the resolution side security, but a little less about the targeted denial of service attacks, because I think that that's been well covered earlier today. Okay. Basically, we have a registry really has two major components, sort of the private side, which is stuff that's sort of all kept in-house and kept away from the main internet. Or at least the internet access that it does have is pretty much to a confined audience. Okay, so basically what we would do is take some pretty basic steps here. We would control access. All of our registrars actually have to provide us with the subnets that they intend to connect on, and only those subnets are allowed to connect for them to the registry. The transactions are all encrypted. We use SSL encryption. If someone calls up and asks for a change on a registrar's behalf, then there are passwords that are associated with that that they have to present to customer service. And of course, we have disaster recovery, so that should something happen to our primary facility, we could fail over to another facility, and all of the data is in real time synchronized to the other facility. Now, for the public side, things are a little bit different. It's a lot harder to restrict access because these services need to be publicly available. So we have to take a slightly different approach there. We can't restrict them as much with access control lists or firewall rules as much, other than the service that's allowed, but we can't restrict the nets that they come in from. So we have to employ some quality of service techniques in order to prevent one or a few users from taking the system down or saturating the resources. Of course, we have secure administration. We don't administer them over the clear internet. And some of the more obvious things, OS and network hardening, and we over-provision bandwidth and resources as much as possible, as much as is practical. Now, for the private services, again, these should, for any TLD, I think, be restricted, because I think, by and large, most registrars would be coming from a single location or a couple of locations and not five or six dozen locations. So all the users really should be authenticated, and we should not accept any connections from anyone that isn't an authorized registrar. And in most cases, we wouldn't even accept a TCP level connection for that. Now, there is a certain amount of upstream trust here. As a registry, data that gets changed is really changed at the registrar end, and it's passed in good faith back to the registry. So if things like deletions and transfers come from the registrar, then by and large, they'll be taken as valid transactions. So we generally will work with our registrars to at least make sure that they have some basic level of security to make sure that their customers aren't disrupted from some other attack at the registrar itself. Now, the reason why we have to go to all these steps is really because the data that goes into the registry is really the foundation for all of the data that's going to get pushed out to the .comnet and org zone files. So if any mistakes are made in the registration process or in the generation process of those zones, then those could actually take customers off of the air or off of the net, if you will. So as a TLD operator, I think you know, we'll all share with you that I think most of the internet really puts their trust in our hands. Okay. It turns out that a lot of what you might see in both the registry side and on the resolution side of the registry is really a lot of misbehavior, and these things happen every day. And some of them can be so significant that, in fact, they could do almost as much damage as a legitimate denial of or an intended denial of service attack. And I'll show you some examples of that in just a moment. It turns out that 15 to 20% of all the traffic that we see on the ComNet and org GTLD servers is 15 to 20% of that is erroneous traffic. Okay, it is traffic that never should have got to that server in the first place. Okay, they're either queries for names that server is an authoritative for, or they're misbehaving DNS resolvers that are continually repeat queries, or in some cases, if people have misconfigured their or not properly configured their Windows 2000 servers, then the dynamic updates will actually try to dynamically update the GTLD, which fortunately we reject. Banner ads are another thing that, while it's a legitimate commercial purpose, they actually affect the behavior of all the ComNet and org servers because they generate so much DNS traffic. These things generally have a very short time, the name servers have a very short time to live, and they're, in fact, probably in the top 100 queries at any given point in time, a significant number of those are banner ad companies. Okay, and broken name servers can actually cause a significant disruption in the system. Not so significant that it stops resolution from happening, because I think we've over-provisioned enough that we can deal with these things on the routine basis. In fact, they happen almost every day. Now, here's an example of sort of what you have to scale for. Okay, what you sort of see here is you see a relatively normal daily transaction here. This is actually updated every minute. Okay, and then you can see that for a few hours out of the day, it goes up by a factor of 10. Okay, so what do you really scale for? Do you scale for sort of the average peak load that you would normally have, or this thing that happens once or twice a day? These things happen every day, and sometimes this is caused by a registrar that's misbehaving, or their software's gotten run amok, and they're doing an inordinate amount of queries, or it's simply just the business model that the registrar would choose to use, which is to during a two-hour period out of the day, look for four or five names until it finally comes available. For whatever reason, these things the registry has to prepare for and has to be prepared for. Any top-level domain registry, I think, will experience these problems as they grow. And the size of that problem and the number of times that it happens is going to simply depend on how many names that you currently have in the top-level domain and how valuable that your names are. Now, here's an example of what can happen when one company's name servers become disrupted. This is an actual event that really occurred on October 11th, actually. What you sort of see is you see the trace of the normal sort of daylight time DNS activity, and then you see this huge spike in activity that occurred because a major internet company had two name servers, and both of them failed at the same time. And this is the volume of traffic that happens from just one company. This was really just one company, and because of the re-query process from all of the clients out on the internet, because of this process, this generated an additional 70,000 to 80,000 DNS queries to the GTLD servers, to all GTLD servers, every second. Okay. Now, so each one, in this particular case, we went from roughly 12,000 here to 18,000, so each one got an additional 6,000 queries per second. So you can see that the GTLDs are in a slightly different situation because the name servers below, just below them, are more likely to be misbehaving than, say, at the root level where the GTLD servers are probably more likely to be behaving correctly. So the root server should not see this traffic, and in fact did not see all of this traffic. This was really directed at the GTLDs. This was not a deliberate denial of service attack. This was something that happened because one of the millions of name servers, which are beneath the .com.net and .org domains, was misbehaving. So, okay, so basically what we do, and what I think everybody here does, and I think you'll hear a similar thing, is that we monitor very closely all of the GTLD servers and the registration process, and we respond very quickly if the system is either being abused or there's a misconfiguration somewhere. We maintain good upstream relationships so that if there is a denial of service attack, we can contact any one of our Tier 1 providers, security staff, and we get directly through. In a lot of cases, we don't even go through their 24-hour knock. We can call these people directly. We've, in most cases, placed the ability to block or limit access to customers, okay, or to users for any reason. If they're abusing the system, we'll block them. We work with some of the software developers. A lot of times, it's a problem in an older version of the resolver or even a new version of the resolver. It's a bug. And by and large, most of the developers of these tools have been responsive. What we have to do next is we have to conduct a mass education of the next level down, because pretty much the GTLD servers will see all of the traffic that all of the customers see at some point or another. So, okay, and that's my comments, and Sabina's next. Thank you.
Yeah. Thank you very much for the invitation to make your presentation. I want to talk about a little bit of our current registry model and how we are looking in registry growth. I think we have seen a lot of name server issues, and I want to show that registry service is not only maintaining a registry. So actually, operational functions of a registry has usually four main duties. That's maintaining the register. The register is actually the database, the heart of the system. It's where it's actually stated which name server is currently, which domain is currently registered for one, which domain name holder. It's maintaining the TLD name servers, and it's maintaining the the registration system. That's the communication between the registry and the registrar, or it depends on the model between the registry and the registrant, which also a lot of CCTLDs still have. And it's maintaining information services like who is accessed via the web. We have additional functions like dispute resolution and things like that, but they are more administrative, so I don't talk about that. These main technical functions are related actually to main technical servers, and these servers have different operation requirements. That's the database server. Database server has to be placed in a secure environment. He has no direct connection to the internet, and we have it was a redundant concept, like it's also VeriSign is doing it. We have a replication of these servers on direct base, so it's done on a direct actually. We have data recovery plans, disaster recovery, and we're doing consistency checks, but we additionally do also, because we don't rely on what we are feeding in there, because there's also the possibility of security incidents from inside or outside, we are making snapshots that we are able to have a backward tracking on a longer scale. We have the name servers, they are redundant, and we have changed our system in the last 1 or 2 years that we have changed from relying on voluntary service, which mostly of the CCTLDs still rely on, to maintaining own servers on a worldwide basis. We share our experience and our efforts with other CCTLDs, mainly with the Austrian one. We have also placed the server FireEye, which we maintain directly. The phone information is directly fed from the database, and there's also consistency checks on a regular basis. We can't do it like the root servers are doing, that we make a full consistency check, because you can't do that on a 5 million domain name records check if everything is okay. and we are maintaining the information server, which is welcome. That's currently our main problem because that's a central service. It's only running in our location. Clearly, we have it also in our backup location, but that's the service which is most often happen to get out of business because of the load assumption which is on the system and because it's actually only in the single place available. We are looking for a distributed concept for the WHOIS for the WHOIS request because we're still, we think that should be also distributed available. It's really redundant, but actually, as I told you, it's based on a single database question queries. So you only have one IP address where the people are querying. So we do it with load balancing systems and things like that. But still, then we see that that's the system which most often got out of business. And the registration server, which is actually, I think, the sensitive part of the system because it handles the registrar communication. It gets authenticated information from the registrar about what have changed to it to the domain name, actually, or which domain name should be new registered. And because of this request, we change our database, so it has direct access to the database. So there are very high security requirements to the server and to the protocol on which we are you are talking to your registrar. So how to improve security in services? Security is always relying on all parts of the process which are involved. So it has to be included in the design of every new process. And it has to be part of all the regular reviews. And it has to be a living part of the organization. We are training our staff on a regular basis on looking in these security incidents. After security incidents, we always get give information to the staff and we try to find out how to improve it to the next time. And security is always as good as the weakest part. We have a risk management at DINIC. Actually, I think it's a special German thing. We are obliged by law, actually, as a private company, to have a risk management set up since 1999. We have a risk handbook, and there is included every operational risk. Our handbook is far from perfect, but we are working on a daily basis on that. And actually, I think it will be never state-of-the-art, but because it's always a working process. But it includes everything. You have to look after what happened if, yes, you have your water supply doesn't function anymore, your power supply doesn't function anymore, and you document on every single page. You document also what happened if sensitive person will leave the company and things like that. And with these looking on the risk, you always look how to can improve your security. So it's always a process where you have you look for the risk and then you look how to improve the security. It's updated and reviewed on a regular basis and gets input from every department. Every department officer is responsible and giving feedback on it depends on the security level of the system he has to report on a monthly or on a quarterly basis. And it lists every critical piece of the organizational infrastructure of the work that's still in progress, of course. So security is not a status, actually it's a concept.
Hi, my name is Federico Nevis. I'm from the .pr. .pr started in 1989. We used it to have a manual system until 1994. And we started a system with scripts running in VMS. And since December 1997, we have a completely new build system based in another concept. And I will show it a little bit. The registration service security, the DNS publication service security, and zone information quality, something that we do that's a little bit different from other registries. The registration service security is basically in infrastructure security, and as any internet service, is vulnerable to security problems, and you have to be up to date on basic services, operating system, SMTP, DNS, databases, HTTP. You have to monitor your network, your servers, and you have to participate on all major security lists and be active. Registration system security. We have a different framework of authentication. We use a hierarchical model with a concept of strong entity in some registries. The owner of the domain name is a property of the domain, and not a domain name is owned by the entity. And the owner, the admin, and the technical information. The basic authentication model uses a mix of cryptography and distributed signatures. It's a web-based authentication using signed passphrase in our database. Database protections, we have inside online replication, online, full backups daily, and outside flat files copies sent daily. The .vr servers, topological distribution, we have 5 servers, and here you could see the locations and the internet transits and AS's of origin, and all servers are continually health checked for common errors and synchronization problems. The geographical distribution of all the 5 servers, we have 2 in Brazil, 1 in Europe and 1 in the US. Zone information quality verification. We have built a multi-threaded, object-oriented DNS client library to achieve this feature. And we are we try to keep the data in our database secure by concept. And when you try to make some change or alter some data in a .vr, we make all the checks online to see if you are not putting wrong data in the databases. We check the delegation for common errors weekly, and we have a policy that don't permit more than 180 days of name delegations or other problems. And a statistic of 1 month of the problems in the percentage of problems in the DNS delegations of the .vr. Even if we take all this care and contact the domain name owners every 2 weeks, we still have around of 11% of problems in the DNS delegations. We have an online version of this data updated daily. This is the policy enforcement. We have 450,000 domain names, and as you could see, this discontinuation on the curve, it was removals by policy enforcement. Could you show this slide, please? At the web page. As you can see, we have these statistics updated daily. It's in Portuguese, but in the right down corner, you could see that we have 85% of our DNS are authoritative, okay. We have 3% of, it's a timeout. It could be a server that's offline for weeks, or could be only problem in the during the check, but we have 11.5% of no authoritative answers. Sem autoridade is no authoritative answer. Unknown domain name, unknown DNS server, failure in the DNS protocol, query refused, canonical names, zone not synchronized, connection refused, and other DNS errors. And that's it.
Hi, my name is Geir Rasmussen. I'm the CTO of the Global Name Registry, which runs the .name TLD. Thank you for being invited. Just that since we're not resolving yet, so I just want to explain it quickly about what .name actually is. .name is a TLD that is meant for individuals. There are 6 billion people out there, so we've constructed a TLD that only uses the third level, which means that you can buy and you can get your first name, .last name, .name. And you can also get a second level email forwarding, which is first name at lastname .name. We don't have any operational DNS statistics yet because we aren't live, but we are going live on January the 15th, 2002. And that leads us into some of the things that we are looking at to ensure that we can provide a stable registry. There are 6 main items. These are not the only one, but there are 6 main items that we are thinking closely about when it comes to TLD security. And that's the data integrity issues. Making sure that the information in the registry is correct, and it's correct all through the life cycle of the data. It is a network. We are providing global service, and that means that we have to have network redundancy, global geographic redundancy, and so on. It's the hardware. We have to have a high-quality and scalable hardware system. And I think that, as Ken and VeriSign have seen with .com, it gets harder and harder the bigger you get, and we think that this will be a fairly large TLD, so we're planning for it. Again, on the software side, we are looking at a diversification strategy on the critical services. I'll get back to that later on. The data centers, we have tried to plan for every conceivable event that can happen, which means that we have redundant sites in different countries. We are able to fail over between these different sites in case of a critical registry failure. And last but not least, the organization. We appreciate that people are not machines. So even if we're pushing the systems very hard, people aren't machines and human errors will occur. So we are planning for that. Data integrity, what does it mean? We're actually using more cycles scrubbing data and verifying data than we are on running the registry. At least that's in the models that we have produced. So we are scrubbing data between the 3 layers in the registry. That would be the application servers, it would be the middleware servers, the databases. We're also scrubbing between the different sites and satellite sites we have. So an example is that we are scrubbing disaster recovery sites against the main authoritative site all the time or continuously. We're also using a lot of cycles on data signing and encryption for transporting data between the different solutions. Network. We have backbone diversity by having relationships with a lot of the backbone providers. These are 4 the ones we're using. We're using Ebone, Colt, MTT, and WorldCom. In addition to that, we are using other backbone providers through relationships in hosting sites, more common ones for some of the DNS solutions. We have sites in Europe, in Asia, and in the US. On the hardware side, we think that the .name TLD might be very big. There are 6 billion people out there. So we are planning for having a registry that can scale to hundreds of millions of people. That means that we are using both a horizontal and a vertical scaling strategy. And if anyone's interested, we can get into that later on. We're also using hardware diversity on services that we deem very, very critical. That would be DNS. So we are deploying multiple versions of hardware to run DNS systems to try and minimize the risk of systematic failure. Again, failure-tolerant solutions and trying to keep the time to recovery between the different redundant sites to a minimum. Software. Again, software diversity. On DNS, we are having a policy that we are using a minimum 2 different DNS solutions. We're using those 2 different solutions on different operating systems. That's the minimum requirement we have as a company. We also want to have full source code control at least one of those solutions. To be able to correct errors if anyone should occur. Data centers. Physical security, as you know, is very important. Also, something you have to take into consideration is geopolitical considerations and also your own staff. You have to have very clear staff screening and you have to have auditing on access to these different sites, which we do using video surveillance. We are running 24/7 network operations out of London, and we are also running operations out of a different country with a different set of staff. Again, we push systems very hard, but we appreciate that people are not machines and we plan for human error. So we try to introduce as many processes as possible to actually avoid this. Thank you. And yeah, there's some marketing stuff. There's a party tonight, so if anyone wants to go, then just tell me. Thank you.
Secure process?
Hi, I'm Marty Linder from the CERT Coordination Center, and I'm the oddball in this group because I do not run a TLD at all. What I do, though, is I receive all the incident reports. We've tracked about 100,000 reports this year, and what I want to go through is talking a little bit about what I think TLD risks are today. I don't want to talk about physical security or anything about the operating system. This is really about buying. Here's a checklist of 7 things that we surveyed over the last couple weeks to get a feel for how vulnerable the TLDs really are. And the 7 items are listed here. I'll go through each of them one at a time. Is the bind software you're running have known vulnerabilities? I think enough people today have talked about that. Do you have people on staff reading the advisories, reading the information from the vendors and other news groups to see when a new vulnerability comes up, if there's something you should do? That's number one. Number two is recursion. TLDs have no good reason to run recursion. It should be turned off. I see no real reason why it should be turned on. It leads to cache poisoning and some other problems. Number three is SOA records. This is mainly for bind because there's other versions of DNS that don't have SOA records. But it's a good thing if you're using bind to have a valid SOA record and return a valid serial number. It's a good way to check to make sure all the zone transfers are happening. And we've seen some reports of people trying to come up with ways of exploiting that. Consistent NS records, lame delegations. In a couple minutes I'm going to give you some statistics. And this number is just mind-boggling. The number of name servers that are listed as authoritative at the root that just aren't authoritative. Does your name server give authoritative answers? There's a large number of name servers that are listed as authoritative in the root, but if you ask them a question, they will not answer authoritatively. Restricted zone transfers. In most cases, there is no good reason for TLD name servers to answer authoritative to everybody and anybody, and a large number of them do. This is a way, hasn't really been talked a lot about here. We talk about DDoS attacks and stuff, but a couple good, please give me your entire zones, can take out a name server because they'll spend all their time returning the huge zones. DNS on multiple networks. You don't want to have all your TLD name servers on the same one physical network and hopefully not on the same AS number so that if you have a network failure, you have another way to your name servers. So we went out and did a little survey, and this is the chart that came out of it. At the top is software version. There are 50 TLDs out of 254 that are running knowingly bad versions of bind. There's 177 where you ask it the question of what version you're running, you get an answer that's indeterminate, like, duh, what's bind? Is what a couple of them respond. You can decide on your own if they're vulnerable or not. You could do DNS fingerprinting and really determine what version it is. We did not do that. We just asked the chaos question, and this is the answers we got. There are 27 TLDs out of the 254 that all of their name servers are running a version that's considered to be good. Of the 254 TLD name servers, name TLDs, there are 207 that allow recursion. So you can do cache poisoning. There is no good reason for TLDs to do recursion. If you turn that off, you minimize the risk to a lot of people. 157 of the 254 allow unrestricted zone transfers. That means at least one name server in their group allows unrestricted zone transfers. This list makes up to 626 individual name servers, 254 TLDs. 148 have inconsistent NS records, lame delegations. That means at least one of the name servers advertised in the root doesn't exist or doesn't answer authoritative. 83 of them answer but don't answer authoritative. 71 of them don't have SORA records for their zones. And 12 of them, based on your network address, not an AS number, are on the same network. All the name servers for TLD are on the same network. From my point of view, working at the CERT, we like to minimize risk. And each one of these is unnecessary risk. So if you don't change anything, don't try to re-architect DNS with DNSSEC or anything else, and just make these changes, that will go a long way to hardening the TLDs. And that's my presentation.
Okay, that's the last of the presentations. I think we can take questions now, if anybody has any.
Hopefully not.
Hello, my name is Sean Dowling. You identified a lot of very good practices for TLDs. You identified problems that some TLDs are having. My question is, for those country codes that are having issues that you identified up there, do these affect the internet at large, or it's their country and they can run their TLD the way they want it, and that's the way they want it? So should we worry about this at the ICANN level, or is this just something that affects those people in that country?
Actually, I think it's first of all, it's a problem of the people operating the system, and it's a problem of the people in the country because they are more directly affected. But I think also that there should be a sort of best practices for CCTLD, or actually for TLD operators, where you can see if somebody is doing a good job or a bad job. And I think according to that best practices, you usually will find out who will be one of the better providers of a service or not. I don't think that there should be a duty coming from ICANN to run the service in a special way or not special way, but I think there should be a best practice where people discuss, and I'm sure there should be also public monitoring pages where you can show up who is doing a good job and who not.
I would say one thing about that, because you asked, I don't know if ICANN is the right place or not, but a poorly managed name server in general, TLD or anywhere, can cause cache poisoning such that an answer can be stored so that people trying to make a legitimate request will be redirected somewhere else. So if a country code has poorly administered TLD name servers, someone can cache poison their name server so ICANN.org points somewhere else. I mean, I won't go through how you do the exploit, but you can do it so that the Brazil, not that they're vulnerable or not, TLD name server has a valid answer if someone asks it, ICANN.org, and it will point to somewhere else. You can do that.
Hello, my name is Rick Weston, and I have a quote I'd like to read to the gentleman from VeriSign. This was published in the San Jose Mercury News, and it's a quote by your CEO, Stratton Sklavos. It reads, "In search of a dramatic description for VeriSign's ubiquitous role in the internet functions," he declared in the interview, "we can take down the network." He sheepishly added that he hoped the quote would not be printed.
It's generally my practice not to comment on things that my CEO said.
Then let me ask you this. If he believes that his organization can take down the internet, what are we doing to ensure that this does not happen?
Okay, I think that's a good question. Okay, first of all, I think that the
quote, because I was not far away when the quote was made, was taken somewhat out of context. Okay, all of the employees who work at VeriSign, and in particular those who work in operations or have access to the servers in any way, shape, or form, actually undergo a 7-year background investigation. Okay, the servers are protected in probably as good a data center as, or multiple data centers actually, as could be expected. So I think, you know, to say that we could take the internet down at any time, I think is you know, you could take that up with him. But we certainly have gone to great lengths to make sure that no one person within our company could cause a catastrophic failure to our systems.
Well, the quote leads one to think that VeriSign could be a potential single point of failure for critical systems.
Absolutely. So what we do is we have, and I think this is going to be addressed more specifically, but not to VeriSign in the next section, but we don't actually have a single point of failure within the registry itself. There are actually multiple locations where the data is replicated to, and in fact we have actually moved all of the GTLDs within the last 12 months, physically relocated them, and most of you didn't even know that that happened. And we've actually moved the registry system twice in that time. So we do have good backup and recovery in case something were to happen to one building. So, Chuck?
A question for Rick. I'm not really looking for an answer. You know, I'm Chuck Gomes from VeriSign. Rick, do you believe everything you see in the news media? I hope not.
Don't answer that, Rick.
Hi. Paul Shuve with Brinks Corporation. Shouldn't we establish, like you said that you diversified the backup and are able to replicate it and so on and so forth. Shouldn't we have a system of checks and balances with another company, and I'm not pitching for my own, but another company that would allow for, in case something was to happen to VeriSign, if VeriSign tomorrow was to be wiped out of the face of this earth, that the internet would be able to be safe because there is a measure to make sure that this kind of thing may not happen. If you're dealing with more than one company, and if a system of checks and balances was to happen with another privately held company, I believe that we may be able to keep this kind of disaster scenario from happening.
Well, okay, I'll address that very briefly, and then I think some of the others may have something to say to that. Okay, first of all, if let's say, for instance, that you know, heaven forbid that you know, VeriSign were to disappear tomorrow, the name servers that are out there won't stop answering queries just because, you know, the building caught fire or something like that. Now, the registration process might be disrupted temporarily, okay, but the data is stored elsewhere, and in fact, some of it is even escrowed, okay? So there might be a small hiccup or even a big hiccup in the registration process, but the resolution process would continue, and I think if something were to happen, the resolution process would be far more disruptive to the community than something happening for a few days to the registration process. But I mean, how do you guys deal with that?
Just also like to add that for the new GTLDs, there are extensive escrow requirements in place, and we are thick registries, and all the data are sent into escrow very, very often. So there will be a backup copy of the data.
And who would manage those escrow services?
We use a company for an escrow company for doing that, and that means that ICANN will have access to that data in case something will go wrong. But again, as Ken says, it's very, very unlikely that the data is so replicated in the first place. So it is in case of a really registry massive failure that would be the case.
Okay.
I was actually handed an online question, but I actually think that this is not for this group, actually. I think it's for the next panel, according to the title that it's for. And I'll let them deal with this question. Okay? No more questions? Thank you.
While the next panel is coming up, which they should do now, it seems that I didn't say this clearly enough. Everybody needs to go sign up for a breakout group in order to not have 50 people show up in one and one person show up in another. You should all go sign up on the sheets in back. They'll tell you the room that you should go to. Pick any group. You can pick some based on language. All the rest will be in English. And the breakout groups will be starting in about an hour. Then we'll have an hour and a quarter after a 15-minute break. So just to make this go smoothly, at some point, please go to the back of the lobby, sign up for one of the breakout groups, and make me happy. Thank you.
Okay. The next panel, first of all, I'm Elliot Noss, and I'm with Two Cows, and I hope to play the role of a true moderator in the sense that I am really the farthest thing from an expert or even a lay person in terms of registries and registrars, recovery and restoration. So I'm really going to look to our well-qualified panel to provide us with most of the input. I'm going to try and facilitate in a couple ways. Most importantly, I think, by trying to highlight, I think we've received through the course of the day a very good overview on a number of the technical issues associated with the subject matter. So we're really going to try and focus on a couple of the very specific registry, registrar issues as they relate to the topic. Andrew has a late subject change. Well, I have it. That's fine. I'm going to briefly introduce the panel. With us is Chungki Park, who is the technical manager of the Korea Network Information Center, the KRNIC, and the KRNIC. And we all know that Korea is one of the most, if not the most, active Asian domain name player. We also have Calvin Brown, who is the director of the .co.za registry, who had a relatively unique experience in relation to both September 11th and in pointing out how truly international effects can be on the internet. We have Dr. Bruce Tonkin, who's the CTO of Melbourne IT, a large registrar from Australia, and Rick Wesson, who is the CTO of the registrar's constituency, as well as the CEO of Alice's registry. And I would point out two things. One, Rick, I'll be speaking to you afterwards about the fact that when you're on the next panel, never ask a provocative question to the previous panel. And if Chuck Gomes is still here, Chuck, you can line up for questions now, because Rick won't be able to avoid them. So with that being said, I will now ask Chungki Park to start us off. Thank you.
Hi, I'm Chungki Park from KRNIC. I'm technical manager of KR. What I'm going to introduce you today is our redundancy and backup system. Okay, for every registrar and registry, the name server is very important for the name resolution service. A few weeks ago, we had an accident. We reloaded an empty zone file. It's done automatically. But people outside of Kali notice it faster than us. They call in. Our homepage is not running. Do you have problem with your name server? Then we check it. We have our monitoring system, but people outside notice it faster than us. And some people threaten us, I'm going to sue you, because our website didn't work, so we didn't have our business going on, so we are going to sue you, but Carol Nick has never been sued yet. He's lucky. Second thing is Huis database. It's very important to guarantee the ownership of domain names. Let's think about for a moment that we lose the Huis database. Then it will create chaos. We don't know who owns which domain. It will take years to find that, recover that information. So we need a backup and redundancy for those two main systems. Okay, let me briefly introduce Kali first. It was founded in 1993 at KAIST, where Kilam Chun teaches. And in 1994, Kali was transferred to NSA, one of the government-funded organization in Korea. But in June 99, it spinned off from NSA and set up as a non-profit organization. And we started to charge for domain names from that time. Before June 1999, it was free in Korea. Okay, the status. We are running 450,000 domain names, and we have 600 domain names are registered, newly registered per day, and about same number of domain names are deleted per day. So we are the average of domain names going constantly at this time. We have 36 staff working full-time and around 10 part-time. Okay, we have special procedures to protect our domain name registrant. The registrant has an option not to reveal his information or her information through Huis database. If the registrant checks no, we reveal only organization name, email address, and name server information through Huis. And in KLNI, domain name cancellation is not possible by the registrant or by anyone. Because if we allow this, someone who wants to take away that good domain name from someone, it's very dangerous. So we don't have cancellation process. But the domain names are automatically deleted if the maintenance fee is not paid. The most of changing process are done automatically, but changing restaurant information, for example, company name and certification number is done manually by our staff. Okay, this picture shows our network topology. We have, in Korea, we have four major internet exchange points. We are connected to three of them, and we plan to connect to the last one next year. We have, as you can see here, we have dual networks so that we can prepare for network equipment failure and to balance the traffic load. Okay, this picture shows our registration system and our system. We have main, can you see the pointer? We have a main database here, and we have web server here. And we post zone file to the name server twice a day. And we have a backup system here, which is supposed to copy the real database real time. But we have, as you can see here, we have heartbeat network. Those two systems are listening to each other, whether they are checking each other, whether they are live or dead. So if the main server is down, all the services are transferred to a backup server. We plan to copy the main database to the backup server real time, but we had a problem that the HA, high availability software, and the backup software did not run together. But so we are copying the data to the remote backup server daily for now. But we plan to copy the main database real time soon. Okay, this is our future system. Everything looks the same, but we plan to introduce competition at the registrar or agency level. So we plan to select some agencies or registrars next year. But the different thing between the VeriSign and registrar and our system is we are going to run the whole database and who is service. And the each registrar or agent can have copy of their customer's database. So in case one of the agencies or registrar goes bankrupt, we have the backup database, so we can recover them. Or if our system goes down or we lose whole database, we can collect from the agencies or registrars and we can make whole database. Again, we can recover them. Okay, as I told you earlier, we have a backup server about 10 kilometers away from KLink outside of Seoul. And our main data are stored in a fireproof vault. And .kr backup server is running, but it may work in crisis situation simply by changing routing tables of ISPs, but we never tried it yet. I hope it won't happen. Our future plan is setting up backup center so that we can have we can transfer our whole services to our backup center. It may cost a lot, so it will take some years to have backup center. Okay, security issue. We have external network intrusion system, and we have firewall, And then we have internal network intrusion detect system. The internal network detection system is closely linked to firewall. So if we detect some intrusion, the firewall automatically blocks the unwanted attempt. Okay, we have server security. We have access list to list control system. Major files are protected by security kernel, and file there is a line behind it. This I will skip it. Okay, virus. Our mail server is detecting the virus automatically, so we delete that mail at the moment of receiving it. And we have a rule-based mail filtering system, and we have a vaccine program to our mail server, and we collect all the information about the viruses from vaccine vendors, and every step has vaccine program on the PC. That's it. Thank you.
G'day. My name is Calvin Brown. I'm with an organization called Uniform SA, and we look after the CO.za registry. Okay, what is Uniform's SA? It basically looks after CO.za registry. I'm then going to go into just quickly what our preparations were, and then I'm going to discuss one or two interesting effects that we had because of the events of September the 11th, what lessons we learned from that, and then some of the modifications which we are implementing or looking at in light of those lessons that we learned. Okay, Uniform SA is a non-profit organization. The CO.za, the main name space, is meant for commercial entities in South Africa, so it's the equivalent of the .com. We've been doing the job since approximately November 95. The ZA namespace follows a delegated model. I would say we're more or less medium-sized registry. There's about 100,000 plus names in the zone. All right, as far as the actual preparations that we had for crisis management and disaster recovery, we do the usual things. We have our main physical location, main office. We do backups via the network to a second or site location. We do weekly backups, tape backups to another off-site location that isn't connected anywhere. We use the standard things like two different upstream ISPs. Our hardware, industry standard Intel equipment, mainly running open source software with some of our own proprietary software that sits on top and does the registration. As far as hardware support goes, we use outsourced industry standard support 24/7 for our response times and that kind of thing. Probably the best part of our crisis management really is our ISO 9002 certification. We are ISO 9002 certified as far as the registration process goes. What that means in a nutshell is we have an ISO 9000 manual that says what we do, how we do it, where we do it. And that is critical to, we feel, to ensuring stability and reliability in this field. All right. Well, we had some interesting effects on after September the 11th, and I've got there that this is all based on hearsay, guesswork, and rumors. It's very difficult getting accurate figures from ISPs as to how much bandwidth they have, where it lands, and their kind of things. They obviously are very skittish about giving this kind of information out. From what I understand, approximately around one-fifth of the South African internet was lost with the collapse of the World Trade Centers. In other words, it actually landed in the building there, and that was wiped out instantly. Approximately half, depending on whose figures and network maps you look at, terminated in those buildings and Telehouse in New York. So after 2 days, when the generators started running out of fuel and so forth, we effectively lost almost half of our internet access in the country. Contact with the route is intermittent, if you could get through at all. Resolving was sporadic, and it was quite a nightmare. You couldn't send email, you couldn't send, couldn't contact news sites and so forth. Okay, the lessons that we learned, the butterfly effect. What I mean by that is never discount the possibility that the butterfly that flaps its wings in the Amazon rainforest will cause a storm in your backyard, as it certainly did to us. Also, some people take for granted that the route is always going to be available to them. It definitely wasn't just, it wasn't available for us following the weeks after that. And that was a real problem. Some of the various plans that we have since revised, a lot of them we're in the process of implementing anyway, and we've obviously stepped certain of them up. We have now received a Class C from ERIN under their micro allocation policy for critical internet structure. That means that our internet should be ISP independent. We have our ASN number now, and we'll be moving towards a full BGP routing as soon as our hardware suppliers get the routers off, which are, should be fairly soon. Local IXP participation combined with maybe caching or mirroring of route information is definitely something that we are going to be looking at with the help of the local internet community as such. You really have to be careful when you run critical internet structure. Things that you don't expect to happen might sometimes happen. Thank you.
Okay, what I want to address, I guess, is that the first part of dealing with a disaster is actually planning for a disaster. The approach that I took at Melbourne IT was to have a look out there and see what else has been done in other environments outside of the internet to deal with security. There are, in fact, standards originally developed in Britain, British Standard 7799. That is a code of practice for information security management. And there's Australian versions of those standards as well, but they're an excellent place to start because they provide an entire framework for planning the security of a registry or a registrar or indeed any internet business. To see a quick, those standards need to be purchased, but if you want to see, a summary of the major points from those standards, the .au Domain Administration has published a registry technical specification which goes into some detail of the sort of security questions that at least the manager should ask their technical department to see if the main issues are covered. I guess the main thing I've noticed with a lot of smaller internet companies, and certainly when I joined Melbourne IT, which provides both registry operations in Australia and is also a registrar for many top-level domains around the world,
whereas there's often not a culture of mission-critical operations. And in fact, the two items I found that were treated in the mission-critical nature were the coffee machine. We had multiple coffee machines. And laser printers. We seem to have a laser printer each, so you could always be guaranteed you could print. But generally it highlighted when reviewing organisations that typically lack a crisis management procedure, so if something goes wrong, everybody runs around and nothing much happens, rather than clearly understanding what your role is in a crisis. Business continuity plans is actually a matter of identifying what are the type of risks that can befall a registry or a registrar, and how do you need to deal with each of the failures that might result from those risks, and documenting the disaster recovery procedures. One thing I would recommend for smaller companies is bring in outside expertise. Bring in people that do have that culture. Bring people. We, Melbourne IT, brought in people from a banking background, from emergency services background, in fire departments. You don't need many, but we had two or three people that had real expertise in crisis management and dealing with security. Oops. The sort of framework that you can look at deals with these things. I won't go into them in a lot of detail, but firstly, you should document a security policy for the company. That would incorporate how's the security organised, who's responsible for it, how do you classify the different systems you have in the company. Personnel security, does your janitor have the key to the root server? Physical security, fairly obvious. And then as you go down, system development and maintenance, as Geer, I thought, pointed out quite well in .name, is really, he's talking about a philosophy for how he actually develops his software and systems, and the fact that he addresses security at each level of software in the system. Then there's a matter of having a plan, and then there's testing the plan, and in fact potentially getting someone externally to audit the security of the company. In doing any risk analysis of the systems you have, the three main things I would look at is one, in terms of data, deal with confidentiality, or another word for that perhaps is how private should the data be. In terms of registrars, in the GTLD context, I guess public access to who is an important issue. Just how much access do the public have? What sort of searches are they able to do? Then you might have a higher level of confidentiality, which might allow your internal staff to perform fairly advanced searches of who is information. And then there's some information your company might have, like billing information, that only designated individuals have access to. Then if we look at availability, we might have in a company, you might choose to have three different levels of availability. And the idea here is in each of your systems, you want to identify maybe three levels of availability or three levels of confidentiality, and then have procedures that deal with each level rather than trying to deal with each single component of your system separately. So examples here is that systems that are requiring very high availability, like 99.99%, you would want perhaps more than two sites, and Melbourne IT runs three independent locations for its network services. Some components of the network and maybe not so needed in terms of availability. The registry database, maybe 99.9%, perhaps at least two sites. And then lower availability for perhaps help services and things like that. The first two, I think, are relatively easy to deal with. The last one is the most difficult one to deal with, and that is data integrity. In other words, how can errors creep into the system and how do you prevent those occurring? Things like the zone file, it's really critical that there are no errors. The registrant, we don't actually want incorrect information about who owns a domain name or who's responsible for a given IP address. So we should really try and ensure that we have procedures that avoid any errors in those pieces of information. Information like the contact details and who is probably less important, but still important. And then, again, you might have a level where it's preferable to have no errors, but you don't put as much effort into protecting against those errors. Looking at the structure we have in the industry now, we have registries that talk to registrars. Quite often registrars talk to resellers. And then finally you have end users. The problem with this model is that the interface between the registry and the registrar is relatively low level. In other words, it's been designed to allow the registrar to take a lot of responsibility for dealing with end customers. And I view that a bit like an instruction set for a microprocessor. There is a protocol between the registrar and the registry, which is a set of instructions that allows the registrar a great deal of control over the information in the registry. But that has problems because an error in that registrar software can corrupt the information in the registry for all domains under management of that particular registrar. And then, of course, the larger the registrar is, the more impact anything going wrong in their system will have on the registry itself. So you can't address security just by looking at the registry. You also need to consider the security within the registrar. And if you have an unauthorised user in your registrar, then you have an unauthorised user of the registry, and that's a critical issue. This flows through to resellers, companies like Melbourne IT, which have a lot of resellers. If we have a software error in the way the reseller communicates with us, that can cascade all the way through to affect the registry. So these are the sorts of risks that are there, and then it's a matter of identifying systems to protect against those risks. And this is where you need to sort of consider what are the types of failure. And what we've seen with September 11th was an unforeseen type of failure. We did not expect somebody would get in a plane and destroy themselves in the process. Our procedures, our risks had been, well, maybe there's a bomb on the plane, but as long as we know the person who carried the bag on the plane is on the plane, we consider ourselves reasonably safe. So that was a case of not identifying the type of failure. Given a type of failure, you then document what to do when that failure occurs. And where possible, try and test those procedures in advance. You need a clear escalation procedure all the way through from help desk to CEO. So the first issue might be someone ringing up the help desk and say, I've got a problem with my domain. And if that can't be dealt with by the help desk, it flows all the way up to the CEO of the company until the problem is eventually resolved. But that doesn't mean the CEO should jump down and start editing in VI the root file. Each of the individuals in that escalation procedure need to have a clear role. So the CEO's role is not to try and edit Unix code. If it's got as far as the CEO, his role is probably to try and get additional resources or additional assistance for the technical people. You need to constantly review and document any time you have a major incident and go back and update the plan. And that's what we see with September 11. We've reviewed what happened and then we're improving the procedures in the airports. Same with the DNS. Every time there has been a major error, people need to discuss it, identify what went wrong, and then work on how to improve that. So it's a case of regular review. The other thing I would say is that in any company structure, the responsibility for security should really be something that is discussed at a board level. Just the same as financial auditing, the security auditing is also the responsibility of a CEO or a board of the company. And we're a publicly listed company in Australia. Our board audit committee that deals with financial processes also audits the security procedures of the company, checks that we have business continuity plans and so on. From a policy perspective, probably the biggest issue, and I think a couple of people touched on it earlier today, but it's often difficult for IT personnel to justify the expense of security. You're spending a lot of money on redundant systems. Gear mentioned that a large amount of his software code deals with checking for errors. So when the boss says, why hasn't this finished by next week? And he says, I'm just putting some more stuff to check errors. The pressure is, well, just get it out the door. We want to start turning the system on and earning revenue. I don't have time for you to worry about errors that may never occur. So there's always that pressure between the sort of market business side and the technical side trying to make sure security is in place. And I think perhaps Randy Bush's comment was that he spent his travel budget coming here and he doesn't have travel budget to go somewhere else. Well, again, that's an issue of prioritisation. Maybe we do need to spend the money so that they can meet and can talk about those security issues. So this is where I think legal and policy requirements for security are useful. I don't think ICANN should start specifying exactly what protocol you should be using on the wire for a particular security issue, but it should specify that security is important, at least, perhaps as a first statement. Things like privacy legislation in Australia are making a big impact on the way countries treat confidentiality of information. Without that legislation, the temptation is to say, well, we don't need to worry about that. That's an unnecessary business cost. Too bad about the end user. But by governments coming in and saying, by law, privacy is required. If you violate that law, you can ultimately end up in jail. Changes a lot of the perspective of the CEO or board on the company. I think that ICANN perhaps should look at the registrar accreditation and even the country code accreditation when they're signing agreements with country codes to try and include some requirements for considering business continuity plans. For example, you might require the lodgement of a business continuity plan that addresses a number of topics. You're not trying to specify how those topics should be addressed, but you at least list the sorts of topics that should be addressed. Best practice guides, I think, are very useful. We saw RFC 2870 discussed today. That is an excellent guide for root name server operations that can equally be applied to country code server operations and even down to the internet service provider running their own name servers for their own customers. I think I'd like to see some best practice guides perhaps in the sorts of checks that should be done on a zone file. We saw some discussion earlier today about checks that were made on the top-level root file, but that's only got 100 or so entries. It's pretty easy to check manually by the human eye. How are you going to check the .com root file with 30 million entries? That's not something you're going to be able to do by human eyes, so it'd be good to share some best practices for some checks that can be made in an automated manner as well as manual on zone files. So finally, I think, to my mind, it's not technology that's deficient in most cases, it's education. And I think I commend ICANN in actually trying to establish this sort of environment to educate people about the issues.
Hello, my name is Rick Wesson. I'm the CTO of the Registrar's constituency. We've heard quite a bit from Bruce about disaster recovery and registrars, and I wanted to talk a little bit about what the registrars... Excuse me for not understanding. Okay, so registrars perform two critical services that we've been speaking about here today, and that we were asked to discuss. The first one being DNS. So when we started looking at this, we've heard it all today. Sometimes registrars are not necessarily responsible for serving the DNS. I decided to take a look at how many registrars actually perform hosting of DNS, and it's certainly not all of them. The registrars actually have a lot of variety between the businesses that are out there. Some of them have a whole multitude of services, and others are pretty much just serve registrations. When looking at the DNS, I decided to do a little research on how much of it is appropriately configured to see how useful all of this 32 million domain names in .com.net and .org are. And I found a very interesting study called from Mice and Men called their Domain Name Help Survey. And it was very enlightening. In one of the points that they had was 78% or 73% of the DNS was misconfigured in such a way that it would prevent people from using those second-level domains. And that really spoke to me. You know, we're talking about securing the DNS and how important everything is, but my gosh, most of it is not necessarily usable, at least from the study in .com. So I would encourage you all to check out Mice and Men and review some of the issues that they have there. And if you are registrars, to take this as an opportunity to ensure that your delegations are appropriately done. And if they aren't, you have an opportunity to go back to your customers and provide them some consulting, some education. The registrars are basically responsible for making delegations within the registries, and in this case, the ICANN registrars within ICANN are responsible for doing ComNet org and other TLDs. The registrars, if one were to go out of business rather quickly, what would happen? Would your domain still work? And I think Sean gave me an excellent analogy in that I'm sure most of you are familiar with title companies for real estate. And if your title company burns down, does that mean you can't live in your house? Does that mean your house doesn't function anymore? So when we're looking at these issues, we have to understand how critical some services are to the operation of internet infrastructure. And I tend to think not everything is so critical that it has to run 100% of the time up. Registrars also run Whois. And we've been talking a lot about Whois, at least within the registrar community this weekend. Registrars are responsible for the Whois that they publish in ComNet and org because of the distributed nature of Whois in that in those TLDs. In other TLDs, the registrars are still responsible for acquiring the information and properly submitting it to the registries, but the publishing is actually done by the registries. The distinction that we use is some registries are thick and some registries are thin. The thin ones not supporting the Whois information about the contact objects. Registrars that provide Whois have many, many different update intervals across the industry. Some do it as almost instantaneous, and some do it at 12 or 24 hour intervals. And so if a registrar's Whois were to be attacked, what would be that impact? If Whois is unavailable for a certain amount of time, does that mean your domain name stops working? Does everything enter into chaos that we can't figure out whose they are? And I'd suggest that small downtime doesn't cause a huge effect. It's certainly something that registrars have to plan for, and in that planning, there's financial implications. But espousing that the Whois is the most critical function here, I think it's not the case. There was also a fine congressman that came and spoke to the registrars this weekend about Whois, and I wanted to make a few points about the accuracy of content. And I feel especially qualified to speak about this because I actually have a process patent in online fraud detection and verification of credentials. And within the United States, there are the facilities for verifying addresses and verifying phone and fax information, whether that they're valid and reasonable. And the thoughts were that we were encouraged to verify and validate every single registration for the entire world. And I would like to point out that other governments do not make available the appropriate information for registrars to, even if they could, amass the amount of information to do validation on email, to do validation on snail mail postal addresses, much less telephone numbers. Telephone numbers, we can come close in the United States being able to tell if it's a cell phone or if it's a directory services number or if it's something that just would never route within the telephone network. But asked to do this on a global basis, it's completely unreasonable because the data isn't available. It's not generated, it's not kept, it can't be purchased. So I wanted to drive that point clearly home. There's the services that we're talking about, the vulnerability of name service. We've talked about the redundancy. Everyone has spoken about that. The zone time to lives. When registrars are creating and hosting zones for their registrants, the time to live is a critical value that you should understand. There needs to be a balance struck between the potential for downtime, should that entire zone expire, all of those registrations in the hosted DNS would become unavailable. That needs to be balanced with the time that you update it to a certain extent. And the port 43 who is redundancy. Often registrars run who is on a database that's external to their actual registrar database and provide updates to these things. So taking out a registrar's who is server may not do that much damage. This information can be regenerated fairly easily and put up on another piece of equipment. We hope that we can work on the redundancy of port 43 who is, and I actually have a suggestion for that a little later. So what happens if a registrar goes away off the net for a certain amount of time? This is one of the things we were asked to think about. Certainly the registrar is impacted in that they can't provide new delegations. And they can't manage or update existing registrations. But the key point here is your current registrations continue to function. And it shouldn't impact the vast majority of the registered active and running domains. So updating name server records and publishing who is, they're critical for information that we consume about registrations, but are the services so critical that if they stopped functioning, would they bring down the entire internet? And the question is, they won't. So there's certainly an economic impact when registrars are considering these various things. If they can't do new registrations, that certainly hurts their bottom line, so they should work towards funding secondary services to provide backup and such. There's also a pain threshold. You know, how long can you survive being down? The fact of the matter is these services across the 100 and some odd active, accredited, and operational registrars do go up and down. It happens. Sometimes you see it in the news, but quite often you don't, and many people don't notice it. And I'm not here to say that it's a big deal, but registrars need to consider how long they can go down, how critical these services are, and how that affects their perceptions. So, recovery strategies. Bruce went over a number of issues that registrars should consider. Distribute your services. Understand the TTLs on hosted DNS. And I would actually like to encourage us and the greater community to use SRV records in the DNS, and to encourage the creation of clients that understand how to use them, so that we can provide services such as who is in a redundant fashion that is more scalable. The BACO and escrow of data, the registrars have just recently been tasked with providing some feedback to ICANN, which we hope to do in one of our breakout sessions. So look for some new plans, and hopefully you'll see some notes from some of your registrars so that you'll know that your data is escrowed either with ICANN or a third-party escrow agent. I think that'll help people feel comfortable in that critical information is actually safely stored by a third party, and no one else can access that. And finally, if we don't ever test this stuff, it'll never help us. So, in that. Oh, actually, while I have your attention and we're talking about security and things, I did want to provide one additional quote, and this isn't anything about VeriSign. My friend Ben Franklin wrote these words: "Those who give up liberty for the sake of security deserve neither liberty or security, and not so much within the context of the internet, but it's surely on all of our minds," and I just wanted to remind everyone of that. Thank you.
Yes, I have a microphone that's working over here, and I hope the panelists do too. If any of you have questions, please proceed to the front. I have a couple myself, as well as the question that was passed on by the last panel, and I now understand their approach. So let me first go to a point. You know, Chunky, you had mentioned that you have a backup database, and that ISPs could access that database in the case of emergency. You know, I'd heard some similar strategies approached by various registries, and the thing that's always struck me is, in order to effect something like that, would you not have to communicate the different IP address or a different location of this backup database to a very large community of either ISPs or registrars in a very short period? And you know, and how would you do that if that's what you would be doing?
Actually, our database is copied to our IDC center that we created. The ISPs in Korea, they are not copying our database. But
so it's in the same location then, and they would have to make no changes. Is that right?
I didn't quite understand.
Well, if there was a failover or something where they had to access a secondary database, would the ISPs have to make any changes themselves, or would everything happen at your end?
What do you mean by database? Is it zone file information or?
No, more the you know, I took it as talking to the live registry.
Actually, our WHOIS database is copied to backup system that is away from KRNIC, which we set up at Internet Data Center. So it will take some time to recover the database from our point.
Okay, Bruce, do you have a similar issue with COMEU? I mean, you have a large, you have a number of folks that are registrars or resellers, at least in that context. Do you have a different location that you use as backup? You seem to, and would you then have to communicate to all those resellers in order to have them use it?
Are you talking about NameServe or?
No, actually the registration facility.
The registration facility, they wouldn't see the change effectively. So it can run off either of two locations.
Oh, interesting. It's not on a separate IP then?
No, we just use the DNS for that.
Okay, yeah. Great.
Hi, it's Paul Toomey from the Governmental Advisory Committee. I just wanted to ask Rick Wilson a few more questions about verification. You mentioned that some things were verifiable and some things were not, and you made the distinction between the United States and other countries. Can you just clarify for me what you thought was verifiable in the United States?
Within the U.S., the Postal Service makes available U.S. postal data, and it's updated once a month or every 3 months. And that, with that data, you can verify and validate that an address is reasonable as far as that the Postal Service will deliver to it, or that the postman has very high likelihood of being able to drop it in someone's box. No validation on the name there. With telephone numbers, it's fairly easy to validate that a telephone number is highly likely to switch on the telephone network. So not that there exists a telephone number, but if, for instance, you wanted to make sure that people weren't putting in directory services numbers, operator numbers, numbers that are used for telephone cards, you can do these kinds of verifications and validations. That there's actually a telephone handset on the other end of that, you can't. That it's a cell phone, yeah, I can probably tell you that much, but only within the United States.
And what speed of time would that take to do? Have you got that as an established system? I mean, how long does that process take? Are we talking minutes, seconds?
There are databases that are available that you can purchase, such as from the Postal Service and from Telecordia, that can help you make these determinations.
If I could just interrupt for a second. Paul, the way I would describe this is syntactic validation in some sense. You can tell this is a well-formed telephone number and it isn't the sort of thing that you wouldn't expect to belong to an individual. but you don't know necessarily who it belongs to. There are reverse lookups that are available, and we make them available at WorldCom. So you could get that information, and it's real time and online. So you could put in a telephone number and get back an address that's associated with it, and a name. But that's not the way you're using this. I think you're using it with databases that just validate that it is at least a reasonable.
There are services available in the United States for doing reverse number verification, but quite often these databases are not updated within reasonable time frames and can be somewhat out of date. If someone happens to move, within 6 months, and generally what we found, we did a fair amount of research on being able to validate information from doing reverse lookups on phone and found that it just wasn't accurate enough and timely enough for this kind of service.
Okay. Has there looked at or tool of verification of company name? Are there any databases that keep company name in the American States?
Drop me an email and I'll do the best I can.
Down in Bradstreet.
Well, just like I could just comment on in relation to Australia, one of the big differences between com.au and .com is we do a lot of validation of the data. And we do actually use government databases that list company names and company numbers. So we actually validate the information on input.
I have the email question, like I said, the last panel has passed on. Joanna Lane writes, U.S.-based ICANN-accredited registrars are doing business with registrants who are members of terrorist organizations such as Hamas, and with registrants from countries where U.S. trade embargoes are in force, such as Afghanistan. The ICANN Registrar Accreditation Agreement specifies, paragraph 372, registrar shall abide by applicable laws and governmental regulations. Is this requirement in paragraph 3.7.2 necessary only to achieve ICANN accreditation or to maintain ICANN accreditation as well? And I'll handle the first half myself, which would be, it seems that perhaps Joanna has some information that the FBI might be interested in, because I would be, as a registrar, I'd be surprised if when registering a domain name, somebody identified themselves as a member of Hamas. And perhaps Andrew or Dan could deal with the ongoing, but I can say that as a registrar, we've always treated the requirement to abide by applicable laws and governmental regulations as an ongoing obligation. I'm sure the folks at ICANN would be interested in any information she has in this regard. Thanks. Jordan?
Jordan?
Yeah.
Hi, Jordan Buchanan, register.com. I think you guys did an excellent job of covering security in terms of, how do we make our servers secure, how do we back it up, how do we recover from our backups later on, how do we put good processes in place. I think I'm a little troubled, though, that we neglected to talk about whatsoever the mechanisms by which information is exchanged between servers and between in our multi-tier system, these sort of like between the registrant and the registrar, between the registrar and the registry. And in fact, I think often that those are the points of greatest vulnerability in any system. And I'm curious if you guys have any thoughts, in particular if you look at like a registrar-registrant relationship, often those are based on like an email template or something like that, easily forgeable. Similarly, a lot of processes that we have in place today are reliant on protocols like Whois, which have no sort of security mechanism in place in order to either validate or protect the data at all. And I'm just curious if anyone has any sort of additional thoughts on what sorts of ongoing steps we might take in terms of protecting the actual flow of data between entities.
Well, I might just comment, Jordan, that the further you go down the hierarchy, if you go down between registry, registrar, resellers, and then finally end users, two things happen. One is the volume of people you're dealing with increases very rapidly. And two, the willingness of people to use security procedures decreases in proportion. So between registry and registrar, I think that is fairly secure. Between registrar and resellers, that probably varies a fair bit depending on the companies. Between registrar and registrants, generally a registrant does not want to communicate to you using PGP or their own digital certificate, nor do they want to be issued a smart card to
to be able to update their details because they soon lose that smart card. And then it becomes a very high customer service cost to actually deal with those problems. So there are technical solutions to that exist, but just the management of dealing with a million odd customers with security certificates and so on becomes difficult.
Yeah, and I think one thing that's important to add is that the more distributed the set of relationships, the closer entities are to the endpoint, and at the end of the day, the best security is knowing who you're dealing with. So the more distributed the environment, the more likely we are to have a reasonable level of that. Eric?
Thanks, Elliot. Hi, guys. I'm going to ask a question about EPP. What a surprise. We have an asymmetric event model in EPP, and primarily why we have an asymmetric event model is because registrars don't want to listen to registries. So I want to point out that this has a security consequence, that it's more difficult to make a system which is capable of recovery and restoring when we have an asymmetric event model, when we have only one mechanism for moving state from one repository of state to another repository of state. So I want to thank Bruce for mentioning we're really talking about protocols, and also for bringing up the subject of privacy, because that's near and dear to my heart, but also for bringing up the issue of cost and whether or not we have protocol design driven also by legal requirement. For instance, a requirement to actually have a registry provisioning protocol that works in the case of failure. So there are about three other areas where EPP could be fixed or improved that would address the issues that are before us in this venue, which is recovery and restoration, both the symmetry of the event model, increased security for the individual instances of communication between the endpoints. I could go on, but that's enough for today. Thanks for your time.
I'd just point out, Eric, that I actually supported the proposal for having registry provisions in the EPP protocol for setting that the other way. So at least to me, you're preaching to the converted. But the comment I would make, I guess, is that, yes, I think there is value in looking at the protocols between the registry and the registrar, and in particular, flowing that protocol information through to the registrar so that the registrant does have some sort of authorization code or token that they maintain, and they use that to effectively authorize the registrar to change their record in the registry. Because without that, any other user of the registrar can potentially interfere with another user's domain. So we do need per domain name security rather than per registrar security.
Howard Elan from Affiliates. This question is for Rick. You'd mentioned quite a bit about having longer TTLs because of having DNS expire, but aren't you really talking about the expiration of value instead of the TTL value? I just wanted to make sure that we're really talking about the expiration of value instead of TTL. Sorry. Is that true?
I was probably, I'm not sure if I completely understand your question, and let me restate it for you and see if I get it right.
Okay.
You're saying that I made a mistake in stating that it wasn't the TTL value, but it was the expiration when the zone expires.
Right. You had mentioned that with TTLs with a shorter TTL, once the slave loses its cache, it's all done. And that's actually the expiration value in the SOA, correct?
And I stand corrected.
Oh, I'm sorry. Thank you.
Hi, I'm Infogon. My question is actually for Dr. Cerf. Does ICANN have any plans of involvement with the Department of Justice for securing corporate interests within the United States to secure cyber squatted domain names?
Not that I'm aware of.
Can I ask the questioner, perhaps if you could expand on that, is this, are you asking about rights in addition to reclamation under the UDRP? When you say, you know, secure dominions, you mean get them back?
Correct.
So it's something in addition to the UDRP?
Correct. If I can, has any plans to work in conjunction with the Department of Justice by any chance?
I'm not aware of any requests from the Department of Justice to work together on that matter. I may be just unaware of it and something that Stuart Lynn would have to respond to, but frankly, I'm not aware of anything like that.
Yeah, is there an issue that you see in advance of UDRP?
Just out of curiosity, if they have any difficulties, will they be working with any other organizations, such as the Department of Justice?
Well, I think you're postulating something that I don't fully understand. I'm not sure that the Department of Justice has jurisdiction in a matter of that type. So I don't understand why they would be asking ICANN to cooperate. You know, we expected any reasonable request to cooperate on some matter would be considered, but this one I'm very confused about. I don't understand why the Department of Justice would be asking us to do anything.
If they had any jurisdiction within the United States, would they?
The matter of domain name, the holder of domain name, by the way, I keep hearing the term ownership of things, and I have the feeling that it's probably more accurate to call someone has a license to something or license to use a domain name for a period of time during which the registration applies. But in any case, these are matters for the courts. The Department of Justice is an executive branch organization.
Mm-hmm.
Most of these matters are resolved either as a matter of arbitration, or in some cases it's treated as a tort and it's a lawsuit is involved. But the Department of Justice only goes after criminal cases. Well, it's not entirely true. They occasionally go after other kinds of civil offenses. But my impression is that they haven't stated any requirement or jurisdiction on this question of domain name cybersquatting.
Yeah, I would add a point that you know, our compliance folks have seen the UDRP work surprisingly well. When I say surprisingly, you know, it was a bit of a unique proposition coming out of the gate. It was much criticized. We're seeing much less incidents of cyber squatting today. The problems tend to be, you know, much more around the gray areas, you know, sort of broadly similar names or people forgetting to renew their domain names, other people registering them when they fall into abeyance, and the UDRP is even being used in some of those circumstances quite successfully. I mean, you know, have you had a negative experience with it?
No, I was just wondering if they actually had any plans, or if the UDRP didn't work, and if there was jurisdiction within the United States, then would there be plans to?
No, I mean,
such a large organization, but I don't know if there's any affiliation with.
There doesn't need to be any special response from ICANN in this matter, because if someone doesn't like the result of the UDRP, the parties are open to litigation.
Okay.
And that's the principal escape valve, as I understand it.
Okay.
Yeah, and there is a task force reviewing UDRP now, and you might want to sort of poke around on that. You know, it is the case that whoever loses the UDRP case tends to not like the process, but okay. Beyond that, you know, we haven't really seen much sort of pushback on it.
Yeah. Thank you.
Ram Mohan, I'm the CTO of Affilias. Question for the panel. What do you think is the appropriate role for a registry or a registrar in the case where there may be a declared national emergency, where you know a national government, for example, requires changes or a shutdown of either its own records or the WHO is itself, in some cases where there's a change in government itself, as has happened just recently?
Well, in the case of, I would imagine that really comes down to the legal situation in that country. In South Africa, for instance, it would be governed by the Constitution, I would imagine, in the U.S. as well, and other countries would be referred to their legal system, surely.
I guess the question is, in some of these countries, the law has just been changed because there's a new government.
Yeah, then you got to. If the government can just change your laws, then you've got a problem anyway.
Yeah, well, there would also
so
be
the
issue.
What is the role of the registry, that is, or the registrar that is charged
with maintaining data and then with its integrity? What should it do?
Well, they would have to, I would imagine, obey the laws in that country.
If I could just suggest to you that the agreements that ICANN makes with the registrars and the registries, if it isn't explicit, it is surely implicit that the entities that perform these functions are operating under the laws of some country.
I believe Joanna Lane has pointed out that it is indeed explicit.
So as a consequence of that, we would assume that these parties would, in fact, follow the local laws. We certainly would not recommend that they break the local laws. It would not be a good kind of agreement to establish.
Yeah, I guess the comment that I can think of that perhaps relates more to, rather than shutting down, which I think is a more extreme situation and really more or less comes down to censorship, and the easiest way of doing that is pulling the plug on the network. But that's becoming more and more difficult because we've got satellite communications and everything else. So most regimes where they've tried to shut down the internet have failed. But the issue perhaps comes down to particularly privacy. As a registrar that operates a whois.com on a global basis, if a particular company says that you cannot publish the telephone numbers, for example, of anybody, any individual, yet we have admin contacts, registrant contacts, technical contacts that have telephone numbers, now that becomes very difficult because the internet generally is not associated with geographical addressing. So I don't know, is an incoming address coming into me or coming into my whois service? I don't actually know what country that address is, that request has come from, and therefore I can't necessarily directly control the output I send out. So I see that perhaps being one of the bigger issues as we get different privacy legislation and who it's specifically related to whois information.
And in that case, is the registry breaking the law?
Well, in that case, I guess the registrar could be breaking the law of that country, and then it's an issue of practically can they do anything about it.
I would suggest to you that this is a matter of incredible complexity, having watched the Yahoo case unfold on two continents, and there's still considerable debate and appeal going on. I think we don't know the answers to many of these questions, and probably we can't literally reason our way through the answers. It's going to be case law that determines what the answers really are.
Hi, I'm Patrick Mazek from Gandhi, a French accredited registrar. And as a registrar, I was particularly interested in registries presentations and about those presentations during this panel on the previous one. I have few questions or comments. The first one is that it seems to me, at least it was my understanding by some registry presentations, that backup plans and system are not tested like if there is a real big problem. It seems to me that like fire alarms are tested from time to time to see if they really work. And I think it was the latest point of Rick's presentation. Backup system should be tested, so registry should switch like monthly or yearly, I don't know, to their backup system to see that everything is in order. At least my understanding of some presentation was that these tests were not done or were not planned. So I think it's kind of an issue. The second comment, sorry, was that I was, of course, happy to see that all registries presented some plans about backup and things like that, so it means that they are taking security into account. But the main problem will be for me that we have to rely on what they are saying. I mean by that, like every comment about a VeriSign code, someday a registry can say something and another day can say something else. So backup plans of registry are good, of course, but if there is no review, outside review of these plans, I think they are kind of worthless because registry, each registry first may forget some points obvious to others. And as in the previous panel, we have seen that there are many TLD badly configured in regards to name server. If registry would have an outside review of their practices, it will be good. Just to finish on that point, it will be of course difficult for them to disclose every detail in public. But at least to registrar, which already have confidentiality agreements with the registry, I think it will be great if registrar can participate in registry backup procedures establishment.
Chunky, do you want to talk about the testing of your backup plans and systems?
Yes, it's very difficult to test live system. But if something goes wrong, we find out whether it's properly worked or not. But we, as I told you earlier, we plan to set up a new system, right? We introduced the competition between registry and registrar level, right? So before we build the system, we will test thoroughly whether the backup system works properly or not. Good comment.
My main point, just to precise my comments, was, for example, about multiple sites, registry on multiple sites. Normally, probably one site is the primary one, is the one working most of the time, and others are only for backup plans. But if others are not tested before the problem comes, it's obvious that something will not have been taken into account, and when the switch will be made, when the problem will occur, some problems will come that they were not taken into account. But that was my main problem. It's of course good that registries have multiple sites, but if all sites are not tested, at least I would say maybe one per year or something like that, problems will occur that were not planned.
Yeah, I think that's right. I mean, just to pick up a couple of points that we do is that we actually use our backup sites online. They're not online to the general community, but they are for us. So, for example, we do reads and administration procedures on our backup database so that we know that the backup database is always working. So our systems are always live in those multiple locations, even if only one is the primary to the external world. The other thing, though, is whenever you do a changeover, you're quite right, problems do occur. But really what we're talking, I think what Rick was pointing out, is it depends on what system you're talking about. And if let's say it was WHOIS, and let's say I shifted our primary WHOIS from one site to another, and something went wrong and it actually took half an hour instead of 5 minutes, that's not the end of the world. And I think that the way we've designed our systems is certainly in the case that we're trying to deal with as many failure modes as possible. But, just like trying to deal with a test of a fire doesn't mean you actually set the building on fire to test it. You do some tests that are reasonable, but at the end of the day, it's when the disaster actually happens that you deal with it.
Oh, I did want to make to comment on the sort of the last bit there about the badly configured DNS. To me, that's not a registry issue, and likely not a registrar issue. Registrars are unlikely to be the folks who are sort of suffering from poorly configured DNS. To me, that's a kind of broader, small ISP or hosting issue, and our responsibility as registrars is around communicating, both in terms of best practices and identifying of folks who are kind of running afoul of this stuff. Rick?
One thing that registrars can do is do validation on DNS entries. I mean, there's literally entries in as glue records that are completely unreasonable in these zones. And registrars, these are things that you can affect. These are things that you can prevent. And these are things that you can encourage and teach your customers to not do. I mean, if we have 70% of one TLD that's incorrectly provisioned, it really makes me question, what in the world are we doing? I mean, we spend all this time and effort and energy working on something that is so completely messed up. Certainly, there's a vast majority of companies out there that you see that have their DNS that works, but there's an awful lot of DNS out there that doesn't, and we need to get it cleaned up, and I hope that we have an effort to do this. I think this is something that's very important, and probably a lot of those names are speculative, so that might give you an idea of the volume of the speculation in the comm zone.
It sounds like Rick's going to be cleaning the closet a bit. Okay.
Yes, Elliot, I think we're going to have to bring it to a close. I'm sorry.
No.
You want to jump in?
Well, I think we're going to have to brief. One last quick question, okay, if we could.
Because I'm listening to all of this, and I thought ICANN accepted some of each individual's money, right, to run itself when they buy a domain. And now ICANN sounds like they're saying, thank you very much, but sorry, we're not responsible. We have no obligations. So, you know, there seems to be an inequity. When I go to a registrar and I say, here's $5, here's $80 to register a domain name, does ICANN get a portion of that?
ICANN doesn't get any of our portion.
ICANN gets an allocation from, certainly from registrars and registrars, yes.
But on an individual domain name basis, right?
It's a complicated proportionality scheme, but numbers of domain names do play a role, yes.
Okay, I thought in the contract I saw something that
it's not ICANN got
$3 for the first 100,000 or whatever, and then...
No. ICANN has a fixed... a budget that gets determined, and then that gets allocated proportional to domain names to the registrars. But it's not as though we get 10 cents or a dollar for every domain name that comes in.
So there's no obligation to...
Put it another way, the number of domain names could triple, and we might not get any more money at all.
Okay, thank you.
Okay. Thank you for the question. I'm going to have to bring this almost to a close. I'd like first to thank the panel very, very much for an excellent presentation and discussion. And let's do that first. But before you escape, the meeting now very much turns much more into we're going to determine who likes to work and who doesn't. And we're going to be looking very carefully. So you follow one camp or the other. And I like to call on Andrew McLaughlin to describe what's happening now in the breakout groups.
Thanks. Okay, so to recap, in about 15 minutes or so, a little bit after 4 o'clock, you should gather in one of the breakout rooms. This here is the current list of breakout rooms. We actually deleted a couple because there was so little sign up. So one note to the moderators is if not enough people show up to have a good discussion, just combine your group with somebody else's. But assuming that people want to show up, you'll see that there's one room each for the Chinese, French, Japanese, Korean, and the Spanish, and we think also maybe Portuguese group. And then there are 7 different group locations for the groups that will happen in English. They're all going to talk about the same thing. It'll be an opportunity to do some question and answer. We've tried to scatter experts through the different groups so that you'll have access to people who know what they're talking about. And then the discussion will proceed through some of the themes from today's agenda to talk them through and to get ready for tomorrow's sessions. Are there any questions about how that's supposed to work? Some of the groups are going to meet in here, so the groups that meet in here will have to just pull chairs into a circle. The rest of the rooms should be relatively well configured. They'll all have easels for people to write on. There's no formal reporting that's expected, but just to further and deepen the dialogue. So I don't know if people aren't signing up because they don't want to participate, but I hope you all will. And what you can do is walk out that back door, sign up on one of the sheets, and if you speak one of the different languages, you can just go straight to that room. So any questions? Finn.
Is the lobby bar multilingual?
We expect it to become so over the course of the session. Okay, so thanks very much.
Okay.
Have a good breakout discussion.